I'll tell you something, E.D.
Montaldo, we co-host a new show called News on the Flip Side. You can catch us every Saturday night, 8 p.m. Central, where we will be discussing current events and topics going on in the world today. We have opinions on everything. There's no topic that we won't discuss, and we'll go places that other shows wouldn't dare. False history gets made all day, every day. The truth of the new is never on the news, but you can catch it here, News on the Flip Side, only on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network.
Hi, everybody. This is Erica Getch. I hope to see you on Friday at 8 p.m. Pacific on the Galactic Connection, keeping you connected 1 hour at a time. For more information, please visit thegalacticconnection.com.
Tune in to UFO Undercover, Wednesdays at 8 p.m. Eastern, with your host, Joe Montaldo, right here on the Paranormal Radio Network.
Welcome to another episode of The Dawn of Shades. I'm your host, Gia Scott, and once again, we have another fascinating topic tonight. But before we jump off to that conversation, we've got our usual announcements to make. For tonight's show, like always, I would love to hear from the listening audience. So please send your questions and comments to me at giascott@exogenynetwork.com. That's spelled G-I-A-S-C-O-T-T at exogenynetwork.com. I promise I won't give out your full name or your email, and I won't send you spam either. So don't be shy. I know you have something on your mind that you would love to have the answer to. And if you're listening in on a podcast, go ahead and send your questions. I'll try and get them answered for you as well. We're also in the midst of planning our next series, so I really want to hear from our audience about the topics that you want to hear about, no matter what it is. Music, Native America, women's spirituality, sustainability, whatever that topic is, drop me an email, post a comment on our Facebook page. You can do it that way, too, and let me know. It's really easy, and it's your way of casting a vote for the topics that you're going to hear presented on the program. So to email me, whether it's questions for tonight's guest or about something else with the program, you can send that email to giascott@exogenynetwork.com. That's also our website, www.exogenynetwork.com, and it's slowly being rebuilt, so keep checking back, and there'll be more and more information all the time. Now, tonight's guest is Ann Gail Rose O'Grady, author of A Time of Change. So, without further ado, I would like to welcome Ann Gail to the program. Ann Gail, would you be so kind as to introduce yourself to the audience?
Okay, thank you, Dee. I'm happy to be here tonight. Thanks for having me on. I just published this book that you mentioned. I'll start with that. I'll start from the current and go backwards. And this book is a transcript, really. It's transcripts of questions people have asked me in group Akashic Record sessions about all aspects of spirituality, about heaven and the soul and our world now and what we're going through. And we found when we got into the records, and we'll go into the records a little bit more later, that Source itself was answering our questions, which was quite a surprise. So the book is the transcripts from all of those wonderful meetings. But I got into the Akashic Records basically because I was a meditator for many, many years, and I would spontaneously find myself in my own records. And it was usually for a particular purpose, like suddenly I'd find myself in a particular past lifetime. And it was always basically to teach me something or to show me something about that lifetime, whether it was a gift that I had gained or something left unforgiven. But my guides would take me on these journeys through all these different worlds. But I found that I couldn't cause myself to get into my own library consciously. So I took a course from these people to learn how to access the records at will or consciously. And prior to that, I was a tarot card reader for 35 years. I taught myself the tarot when I was quite young, and that evolved into doing psychic fairs and doing personal readings for people. And then I went on to teach tarot to people, and I was actually taught how to heal with the tarot cards as well. So it evolved from being a fun kind of fortune-telling tool to practice. And from there, I went into reading the records, which is what I do privately now, as I read the Akashic Records for people privately. And prior to that, I studied many aspects of consciousness. I had a tragedy occur to me when I was 18 years old. I was married, my high school sweetheart, and 3 months later, he was killed. So it made me suddenly want to ask all these questions of spirit. And prior to that, I would have said that I would have been content being a housewife and a mother. But that changed my life, and I look back and I think that was probably a karmic contract that I had with this gentleman, because it catapulted me into the spirit world. I went to my very first psychic and wanted to know the details of his death, because nobody seemed to be really clear about it. She became my first teacher, and she would allow me to come to her home once a week, and for an hour I could basically pick her brain on various spiritual topics. And then from there, I was on my own path. I moved around quite a bit in my life, but I kept being drawn to different modalities, such as rebirthing. I studied rebirthing for a while. I loved the whole concept of physical immortality that Sondra Ray and Leonard Ord used to talk about and teach. It felt really right to me. I've had experiences with UFOs and, you know, memories of being on other planets in tunnels. My whole journey, you know, was consciousness expansion. I really got into thought being creative and proved it for a number of years, and got into manifesting and journaling and then teaching classes. Anything I learned, I started to teach classes on. So I've been a teacher for about 40 years on all aspects of spirituality and communication with nature, because there was a part in there where the elemental kingdom came to me and the animal kingdom and asked me to start doing grid work in certain locations, you know, altering the grids on the planet or fixing, let's say, a dead aspect of the forest or something. And even though I wasn't officially taught how to do that this life, there was a part of me that remembered how to do it. And so I did that. And one of my little hobbies is that I make little fairy dolls at the request of the fairy kingdom. So I've had, you know, years and years of just learning to do these things. And
I'm still going. I hate to interrupt you at this point, but we do have a caller. Caller, if you could make sure that you turn off the audio in the background, we'll get a lot less echo. And go ahead and ask your question. Are you there, caller?
Yes, this is Kevin.
Okay. Hi, Kevin. Can you turn off the audio for the program?
Make sure to turn off the audio in the background. Hello. It was so loud. I can hear well enough. The question is, are you a good witch or a bad witch?
Well, I don't perceive myself as a witch at all. I might say that I actually dabbled in witchcraft for maybe a month of my whole entire journey. And it was an old memory. You know, I just knew how to make circles, and I perceived myself at that time as having some history in a lifetime of working with nature and the angelic realm in a positive way. So, but I don't practice witchcraft now.
How do you define witchcraft?
Well, I define witchcraft as using rituals with nature and other elemental forces to produce a particular result, as well as maybe rituals for celebration and things like that.
You don't practice the tarot anymore?
I practice the tarot. I don't really use the tarot anymore. I still teach it if people ask me, but I don't use it myself.
Okay, Kevin, does that answer your questions?
Well, I had a couple more. I'll go back.
Okay.
Go ahead and finish telling us your story, Angel.
Well, that was basically summarizing it. I don't consider the tarot witchcraft, if that's what Kevin was implying, that it would be witchcraft. And I'll just explain that to anybody who may have a concern, because I was naturally attracted to the tarot years ago, and I found it fascinating, and I mentioned that I learned to read it myself. But, you know, as I worked with it through the years and I grew with it, it actually became a really powerful spiritual tool for me in terms of self-reflection. It actually would show me aspects of my personality that really needed some refining. So there's so many levels, but I will say that I did have probably a 7-year period where I would be challenged by family members, or, you know, the little knock on the door with the Bible preachers, who of course don't know you and they don't really know what you're about, but it seemed to me that they'd always have their little book where they'd show me pictures of the tarot cards and how evil they were and all this. And it actually took me 7 years to work through fears around that, because I was raised Catholic. And So I call it an initiation. It was an initiation I went through to always self-reflect back to myself to see if these were really something positive and useful, or was there a danger in them. And I finally came to the conclusion that they had served me and served others that I read really well, because I was never the type of reader that was a fortune teller, in the sense of, if somebody called or came and said, I just want you to tell me what's going to happen in my next, I would never read from that level. It was always more of a counseling conversation, and always brought into consideration what the person's soul journey was about. So I just thought I'd clear that up. I don't
know. Well, I know that when I was learning, learning about tarot, several of the people that were teaching me taught me that the tarot cards essentially remind you of what you already know.
Yes.
That it was a tool, no different than a pencil or something else would be a tool. So, you know, using that as sort of a yardstick, you might say, mm-hmm. I guess I just don't see much witchcraft in tarot.
No, there are powerful symbols in there, though, and I found that out when I was being guided to heal with them. And I'll give you an example of what we did. We have a class where, let's say, somebody had an issue, for example, okay? And we had them pull a major arcana, and then someone would take the card and walk into the person's auric field with the card. And they could be probably 20 feet away, and the person would start tweaking, you know. They'd start feeling that energy shift their aura and move things around. But ultimately, what would happen in those few minutes is the issue would kind of come to the fore, and then it would just disintegrate. And that was really, really wonderful, because that was just strictly from the image on the card and the symbols that were in it. Yeah.
Okay, that is interesting. I've never seen tarot cards used that way, but even in that, I guess I'm not seeing that as, I guess, the traditional cauldron witchcraft thing. And, too, you know, even a pencil can be used in witchcraft if you so choose to do so.
Right.
I mean, anything can
And you
be.
Are right. I do think it's how they're used, right? Which determines, you know, whether they turn into a tool that is nasty or there's something that uses to uplift someone. But, yeah, I never considered it witchcraft either, although I think the term that was always reflected back to me was that they were the occult, and the occult was always something, you know, to watch out for, and, you know, that's a lot of the propaganda that's out there.
The goblin anyway. Under the bed that was going to get you.
Yes.
Yeah, there's a poem, I read it actually at Halloween time on the program, but it's called The Goblins Will Get You If You Don't, or, yeah, it has a line in that, like that, in about it. And,
yeah.
You know, it really is kind of the way that, you know, growing up, because I grew up in a very conservative area. And while my family wasn't so conservative, I was continually exposed to it at school and with my friends and everything. And the occult was literally the goblin that was under your bed and it was going to get you if you didn't watch out.
Yes, that's right.
And, you know, adulthood has taught me there are no goblins under my bed, and the occult isn't going to sneak up and grab me when I'm not expecting it either.
Right. Mm-hmm. Now, I know that there were certain cards that, you know, were developed, certain types of cards. I mean, there is the Witch's Tarot. There is, what's his name? Can't think of him now. Darn it.
Aleister Crowley, maybe?
Oh, yeah, that's the one, okay? Who, you know, are rumored that he kind of went off the deep end at some point. I don't know if it's true or not. But, you know, they can be used for ritual purposes, I suppose. But again, like you say, you could use a pencil for that, or you could use of your intentions to do something nasty to somebody. So.
Right, and so, you know, there again, if we went eliminating everything that could possibly be used for a negative purpose from our life, we wouldn't have, we'd be living in caves for sure, and even fire, you know, fire can cook food and keep you warm and light your world up, but it can also burn you and kill you, you know?
Yeah, that's true.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, you know, anything, everything. Can be either positive or negative, I suppose.
Right. That's true.
So when
but
we're...
Go ahead. Yeah, but I did have, early on in my journey, you know, I did have relatives send me books on possessions. They were sure that I had, you know, gone the wayward way. It's always your family, I think, that your relatives that kind of challenge you to be sure of what you're doing and question what you're doing. And looking back now, I laugh about it. I know it wasn't funny at the time, but I really did learn a lot from what they sent me, actually.
Well, too, and our families have known us from our earliest and most innocent days. And sometimes I think they fail to realize that we're not still that three-year-old that went, why? 400 times a day.
Yeah, I know.
Especially if they're like me and they still go, why?
Yes, yeah. I know. Well, that is true. And I even think on my past, you know, I had a really big issue with my mom because it would be like I'd want to tell her, you know, all these new things that I was discovering. And she would speak to me as if I was this silly little girl that she knew way back when, and not an adult who might have something interesting to say. And it's took me a long time to understand that she didn't have to listen to me, and she didn't have to take any of this on board because it didn't jive with her Catholic faith, and that it didn't have anything to do with her not loving me. And it took me a long time to really understand that, but I did learn it, you know. And now she actually asks me questions, which I find interesting.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting to see how one's interactions with your family shift and change over time, how people choose different paths even though they may have started out in largely the same place.
Yes. Well, I know I was a devout Catholic for many years. You know, I used to love the rosary. I used to pray the rosary every single day, and that was all the way up through high school. And like I said, it wasn't until my husband passed away that I started inquiring into other things, and it really, you know, took me on a whole different direction.
Well, I have to admit, growing up without much of a religious foundation, which in itself is kind of a long story, we didn't belong to any organized religion as I was growing up, and it's sort of, I had to defend myself against my peers' beliefs and even the accusations of adults in the local churches at an early age. So I had to think about, you know, as a kid, what do I do? Do I or don't I believe in? And I had to defend those.
Mm, wow.
And so it did kind of make me a little hard-headed, I guess. you know, I didn't buy into, you know, just believing some doctrine because I was told to, ever. Mm-hmm. Because I always had to question it. I always had to defend where I stood on something versus my peers, and I never had the safety of numbers. I couldn't hide behind that.
Right, yeah.
And that's, you know, for a kid, it is an awkward position to be in, I'll admit that. But it was probably good for me.
Yeah, that sounds, I actually think you're lucky to be able to have that, because it took me until I was in my 30s to really even realize that I had this devotion, let's say, I had this devotion to Jesus, to be like Jesus, to live my life like Jesus, you know, be the good Christian, be loving and forgiving. I mean, I'm still that way now, but there's a point where historically I suddenly realized there was no way that I could really know, you know, what went on back then and who Jesus was, and even if he really existed, if I dare say so. And I was a shocker to me, because I realized I had built this whole identity on this person that everybody told me I should be like, and I kind of was in a shock and said, gee, who would I be if I wasn't doing that? And that was another huge turning point for me.
Yeah, I imagine so. I think back, you know, to when I was a kid, we were allowed to visit any, you know, a number of churches. We could visit anyone we wanted to. I usually never went back a second time, I'll admit that. And that was part of the reason that I didn't belong to any of the churches, is because the experiences were so enlightening, you might say, about the nature of many religions. But I found the Catholic religion, with the ceremonies and rituals and the nuns and the priests, absolutely terrifying, because these nuns didn't look like anybody I'd ever seen before. Mm-hmm. And they dressed funny, and you didn't know what they would do. I never had heard one speak to me until I was an adult. And that's when I discovered they're just normal people. But that, as a child, you're seeing them, because I would only see them, like, if I went to the movie theater or someplace, a store or something, where they happened to come in. They were terrifying. Mm-hmm. We didn't even have a Catholic church in the town I lived in. So, you know, it would be like when I'm visiting my grandmother or something, I would see them, and it was like, you know, why do they dress funny? Well, you know, my grandmother was a Protestant. She really didn't have much of an answer, and, you know, so it was this huge mystery, and they were scary, mm-hmm. because of the strange clothes to me, you know, and it wasn't until I was an adult that, you know, I even really knew what a nun was, besides somebody dressed in funny black and white clothes.
Right. Yeah, and I thought of actually being one at one point in my life, in a moment of insanity. But anyway.
The girl that was in my class at school, that was her plans. I don't know if she ever did become a nun or not, but yeah, that's what she said she wanted to be when we were in high school. So, you know, in high school I did have a number of Catholic friends, and I had been to, you know, funerals and weddings and Catholic churches and stuff, but, you know, there was still that, I guess you might say, element of awe. The rituals kind of, because I lacked ritual in my own life, I couldn't see them as being accomplishing much. You know, when you would ask, you know, you would get these answers that made no sense to a child.
Right.
I mean, just they didn't make sense. the adult's reaction when a child would ask questions that seemed perfectly legitimate to, you know, a fifth grader, like my experience in a catechism class, and we're being taught about communion, and I point out that it's ritualized cannibalism, and I'm sent home. And maybe I saw things in a funny way, but that's what, you know, this is my body, this is my blood, this is kind of gross, you guys.
Yeah, right.
You know, that's what it was to me. You're pretending to be a cannibal.
Mm-hmm.
You know, don't you see that?
I did find out, like I told you when I was introducing myself, that I was a meditator for many years. And I was taken through all the sacraments of the Catholic Church and shown them on a mystical level. You know, not what they teach outwardly, but what they symbolized in terms of archetypes internally. So luckily I did get to see a more mystical side to that, but unfortunately that's not what they teach people.
And as an adult I understand the symbolism behind the symbolic cannibalism, you know, that by consuming the body of someone that you revere, you take on their qualities. But a fifth grade child doesn't get that, especially when they don't get an answer.
Right. Yeah. But I don't think they had the answers on a mystical level. So I think it's the reason why they shut everybody up. And my current husband was like this.
Yeah, you learn it by rote. And that's the right answer.
That's right.
Yeah.
My husband had that too, where he questioned, and they silenced him.
You know, even today, I look at rituals, and, you know, I understand the need for rituals, and whereas I don't have mints in my life, I'm not sort of an anti-ritualist, non-conforming sort of person, I do understand their importance for people. And many rituals are a tool to focus your mind.
Right.
Now, I do have, you know, when I need to focus my mind, I do have a few rituals that I use, but they're actually pretty simple. Most people are never going to realize that I'm, you know, doing anything like that. But they're the tools that I need to do what I need to do.
Mm-hmm.
And when you tell people that the rituals are merely a focusing tool, it's like, you know, turning the knob on your binoculars so that you can see what you need to see, they're horrified. And I'm like, that's the purpose of it. That's why you do these things. You're focusing on this purpose, whatever that purpose is. And,
right.
You know, they just don't want to see it that way. To them, the ritual has become the end.
That is true. Yep. Well, I've not ever really been a ritual person either, aside from, you know, when I used to say the rosary. I think that was probably, I would call that a ritual of sorts, and it would help. But I never really did. I was never attracted to ceremony and ritual like that. And today, I probably wouldn't even do anything like that unless it was a celebration of some kind. You know, unless it was to celebrate the earth or celebrate creation or something.
Uh-huh.
But I'm somebody, too, who's not ever really used rituals. You know, in terms of any sort of a formalized, you know, traditional way to do things, which is the other reason why I answered the witchcraft question like I did to the gentleman caller, was my idea of practicing witchcraft is that it very much uses rituals and elements from nature to achieve particular ends.
Now, with Akashic Records, okay, what exactly are they?
Okay. Basically what it is a recording process. And what the truth is that anything that has ever existed in creation is recorded in spirit. It's almost like data. It's information that once something has occurred, it's there in the memory field of the universe. And Akasha, you know, if you go to a dictionary, it'll say that it's a Sanskrit word that means ether or some people think it means sky, which implies a particular plane and spirit where records are kept, similar to a huge library. So, you know, the thing is it does appear as a library to some people, a huge, vast library. I certainly have had experiences where I've walked up staircases and seen just billions of books and would be shown my own particular book where I would literally pull it out and read about a lifetime. But actually, since then, I find that the records can be found anywhere through all of creation. They're in the cells of your body. They're in the rocks outside. You know, the memory of creation is everywhere. So the Akashic Records are really considered the library of history or the library of creation. And it's on an energetic level. You know, it's a frequency band in spirit there where you could access the data. And but so let's say if you lived in a different universe entirely, they would still have their own history and it would be operating on a different frequency band. So that's how I view the Akashic Records. It's really the library of all of creation, and everybody has their own particular, let's say, library book or their own particular history or time stream. Another way I explain it is that when people have a near-death experience and they say that they saw their whole life flash in front of them, they're seeing their records. They're seeing the unwinding of every single thing that happened to them in that particular lifetime down to the minutest detail. So that is what the Akashic Records are. They're really a field of vast information of the all that is. That's the way I explain it.
Uh-huh, okay. Mm-hmm. And so accessing these records, how is it done?
Well, I do it by a special prayer that I was taught. It was an old Mayan prayer that you say it in such a way where you just end up in this field of information. And I couldn't tell you how the prayer actually puts you into that frequency band, but it does. It just does it immediately.
Uh-huh.
And so, you know, at first I was taught to read my own records. That's done a particular way. The prayer is said a particular way for your own records. It's said a different way for other people's records. And I've even altered it myself to get into what I call universal records, which are, you know, it's information that's on a more universal or spiritual level. But I was taught, I mean, like I said, before that, Gia, I used to be in meditation, and my guides would suddenly put me in a past lifetime or put me in, you know, the library to show me something. It was done by them, and I couldn't tell you how they did it. But you can learn to do it consciously. There's people actually teaching people how to get into the Akashic field.
Okay, and the next question would be, what would be the purpose of doing that?
Well, I find that the ability to understand who you are and who you've been and what you're doing here is of immense value, because each lifetime, you know, is set up to have a particular purpose to it, in the sense that, you know, the soul wants to keep gaining experiences and gaining wisdom and mastery, really. I mean, ultimately, we all want to end up as a creator in and of ourselves, because that is what creation is. Oops, sorry about that. That is what creation is really about.
Uh-huh.
I've given the phone to my husband. Sorry about that.
Okay. I know how that goes sometimes.
Okay. But let's say I'll compare it to when I used to read the Tarot, for example. Okay? When I would read the Tarot, a lot of what I would see, everything to do with my own level of expertise, you know, my own level of sensitivity, psychic ability. I could have good days, I could have bad days, I could have people who would come who, where I couldn't see anything for them, and then the next day I'd be seeing all this information. But I have to say that the records feel like a particularly different vibration altogether. There is a sacredness about it. There is a holiness about it, because you are now dealing with the spiritual level of a person. You're dealing with their whole reason for living. You're dealing with their gifts and their abilities. You can see through their different lifetimes where they've been stuck, where they've had trouble, what they've succeeded in. And the soul really does make a contract of things that it wants to get accomplished in a particular life. You can see that for the person. And you can see how well they're doing, and they know as soon as you start talking about it. So, to me, in terms of the understanding that you can provide for people and for yourself, I think it's immense, because there's also lots of different lifetimes that are unreconciled in people. And let's say they come in this life and they're meeting the same people all over again, to be, you know, either to complete something from the past, heal something from the past, or go forward with something from the past. But I tell people that 99% of everybody you meet, you've known before. Okay, and so it can help people understand the relationships, their friends, their enemies, who they are on a deeper level. It can tell you stuff about your health. I mean, there's just no end, really, to the benefits of reading somebody at that particular level. And let me say that I think the biggest thing that you gain out of it is you understand that there's no judgment. I mean, there just isn't. There's no judgment. Nobody's judged. Everybody's loved. Yes, there's stuff to reconcile, but that has to do with the individual soul becoming more refined as a being. So it's, you're just left with compassion for people, because you can see how they got to where they are or why they're struggling. And I wouldn't always see those levels in the tarot. I may not get to those higher levels with somebody, if you know what I mean.
Right. That's interesting. Now, if somebody wants to learn more about the Akashic Records and how to read their own or somebody else's, you know, where would they start?
That's a good question. If they wanted to learn to read their own, I would, you know, honestly, I would just tell them to Google and see if anybody's teaching it in their area. I have not yet taught it. I've been asked to teach it. I haven't done it. And certainly they could go into meditation and work with their own inner self. But my experience of that is that you still wouldn't be brought to your records unless you were ready for it. Because it is a particular frequency band that you kind of grow to, you know? It's the reason why I do think, like, people could consciously learn how to read the records, but, you know, how well they'd be able to downstep the information and how accurately has everything to do with themselves.
Mm-hmm. Okay, but I'm just thinking, like, in my own case, I live in the heart of the Bible Belt. you know, there's probably not going to be anybody within at least 100 miles that teaches that. New Orleans would be the closest place.
Right. Well, you know, in your case then, I would go in if it was something that I really wanted to see. I'd go in and when I do my own quiet time or whatever, you know, and I'd talk to my own higher self and say, I'd like to have an experience of something in my records that would benefit my life right now. And just wait. Because back in the day when I meditated every day, that's how I did it. I didn't go in to ask about the records, but I would go into a meditation to be taught. I never went into a meditation to still my mind. I went in and I said, okay, higher self, I have, you know, an hour and a half today. Teach me.
Uh-huh.
And it took me a few weeks. You know, I'd start getting colors, and then I'd get symbols, and then I had to interpret all those, and it it went to direct telepathy, and then it went to journeys. So, you know, I just think that if you are consciously going in to say, show me something about my records or my history that I need to see that would benefit me today, I think you could start getting your own answers that way.
Uh-huh. Yep. Well, it sounds like something that would benefit everybody actually to learn about.
Right.
Mm-hmm. You know, and it certainly doesn't sound like something that can cause harm.
Oh, I don't ever think so, because, you know, the truth about the records is that if anybody's trying to get into the records, let's say to, you know, snoop on another person, for example, you know, it won't work. It won't work because they're at such a frequency band that it's almost like they have their own safeguard, you know, that if your motives aren't, you don't have permission to be looking at anybody else, you'll just see a big blank wall.
Yeah, well, that's kind of cool, too, because, you know, there again, we've all heard the horror stories about, you know, somebody using some occult practice to snoop on someone else's most private thoughts and hopes and dreams.
Yeah.
And, you know, that idea does make people a little uncomfortable, and I can certainly understand why, because, you know, I have a pretty good imagination. I can imagine feeling that way. And I wouldn't like it any, and I don't expect anybody would.
Right. That's true.
You know, you do expect your own thoughts and hopes and dreams to remain private except for those you choose to share them with.
That's right. So, I'll tell you a funny story, not with the records, but years ago. It's really funny, when I used to say the rosary, I'd go out of my body from saying it.
Uh-huh.
But this one time, I had this boy that I liked. I think, how old was I? Maybe 23 years old, let's say, right?
Uh-huh.
I was saying my rosary. Next thing you know, I found myself out of my body, and I said, oh, let me go see what so-and-so's doing, you know? So it's like in the middle of the night. And suddenly I was walking through these walls, and I saw what he was doing and this and that. The next thing you know, my spirit just wham, like threw me back in my body, you know, like scolding me like inappropriate, you know.
Yeah.
But, you know, when you're in your 20s, that's what you care about, you know. Oh, yeah, I like this guy. What's he doing, you know?
So
I said, that was obvious. Lesson there, and of course I checked it out with him later, and that's what he was doing, and that's where he was, and he was a bit taken back to think he was being spied on, which he was. So,
well, yeah, you know, that would make most people a little uncomfortable, and actually, you know, for most 20-somethings, that would probably end prospective romances real quick, because...
Well, yeah, I know.
Yeah.
Well, it didn't with him, only because of certain connections that we had. But, but you see, it's the same thing. People can use tarot cards the same way also.
Uh-huh.
If you're interested in someone, you sit there and pull cards, and what's he doing? And, you know, I don't know how many people who want readings and they're in love with a married guy, for example, and they want to know, is this... You know, what's their relationship like? And I won't answer those questions, you know?
Right, like, right.
It's their business, really, you know? So.
Yeah. So, yeah, that does make sense. And, you know, I guess in another way, you know, most people's first experience, like yours, where you ended up out of body and you went to see what your romantic interest was doing, that was sort of an accident. It wasn't like you were deliberately attempting to spy.
No, I think it was curiosity, you know. I think I was surprised to find myself out of my body, first of all. And then I thought, well, now that I'm out, gee, I wonder what so-and-so's doing. So that part of it was a deliberate desire to see what he was up to. So that part wasn't kosher. You know, I mean, that's why my spirit threw me right back in my body, you know, like scolding...
Well, actually, you were probably lucky, because for probably 9 out of 10 people doing that, you know, get this curiosity and act on it, you know, in their initial out-of-body experience, which usually occurs by accident, not deliberate intent.
Yeah. Yeah.
They see something that they wish they hadn't seen.
Oh, yeah, that could happen, all right.
Yeah, sure. that could definitely happen. And, you know, oftentimes the question they asked wasn't one they really wanted to know the answer to.
Yeah.
Or what they wanted to see wasn't something they really wanted to see. So, you know, whether it's romantic interest or, you know, what's happening at school or what's happening at work or whatever, you know, a lot of times people see things that they shouldn't have seen, didn't want to see, didn't want to know.
Right.
So, you know, that old adage about watch what you wish for.
Yeah. Be careful what you ask for.
Yeah, yeah. So it's the same sort of thing.
I think too, though, Gia, you know, in terms of the whole privacy idea, that I think we're all being very conditioned in our outer world to expect being spied on, which is really unfortunate. You know, it started with cameras. Remember, cameras on every street corner, and you know, the whole remote viewing, which is really spying. I mean, it was created to be a weapon, you know, or you know, spy weapon for war and governments, and all of this stuff. So, you know, subconsciously, you know, we've been slowly spoon-fed this idea that we need to be watched in order for our own protection. And, you know, that whole thing is really distorted.
Well, and that's gotten much worse since 9/11 as well. I mean, we expect our emails to be run through, you know, a government digestive process to make sure we're not all terrorists. We expect to be practically strip searched as we board a plane. We expect our mail to be triple screened to make sure we're not mailing each other anthrax virus or something. You know, and so the list goes on and on and on. And things that were very private even when I was a kid, today you may as well do them on the street corner.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's just the way it is. We're just expected to share a whole lot more about our lives, and there's less personal space, you might say.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you can even look, you know, if you have somebody's address, you can usually look at their house.
I know.
You know, and that's kind of creepy in a way.
It is creepy, yes. Mm-hmm.
You know,
it is creepy, and I think that, you know, so many people that I have spoken to really buy into that and really believe that that sort of stuff is necessary for national safety and personal safety, and they buy into the line and sinker, and I just think you guys are crazy, you know, to think that that's necessary. Because of a few bad apples. I mean, you know, of course we could go off on a tangent and talk about 9/11, but I really don't want to. But
well,
this sort of thing is
throughout our entire society, from our food, being told where it can come from, where it can be sold, what kinds of it can be sold,
right,
and that in some cases that we can't even produce that food item ourselves for our own consumption.
Right. That's right.
You know, that's the kind of invasiveness that 20, 30, 40 years ago would have been met with rather violent rejection by the general public. And today they're like, oh, yes, let's make it safe for everybody.
Right.
You know,
I know, and even the whole GMO foods is such a huge abomination, in my opinion, in terms of what it does to us biologically, and then they won't label it for people so they can even make a healthy choice. You know, really, it does go on and on. It's just really surprising to me that we're not fighting this more than we are, although I do know there are many, many petitions out there that try to stop this stuff, and for some reason it doesn't seem to work. The lawmakers seem to do whatever they want, regardless of the public. But yeah, I mean, corruption on a pretty scary scale. In fact, Source does address some of this in the book, and really warns us about certain things. So, yeah, very interesting. All right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, all this uniformity. I have worn uniforms to work, you know, in the past and whatnot, but I'm not real good at being a uniformed drone, I guess.
Yeah, drone is a good word.
I just, I've always marched to a different drummer, and find the thought of a universal beat kind of creepy. You know, it reminds me of Star Trek and what do they call them, the cyborgs or whatever they were. The Borg. Borg, that was it. You know, you will be assimilated. I'm kind of feeling like we're being assimilated. You know, the hive mind, and everybody looks and acts alike, lives alike, etc. That is kind of a creepy thing, because we're all individuals with our own individual journey and lessons and everything.
Right. Absolutely. Absolutely. In fact, I call it the artificializing of the human.
Yeah.
That's what it looks like to me. When you look at it from the level of the Akashic Records, especially with the food, it looks like it's really trying to change our internal organs to make them less sensitive, to make them not as organic in terms of their own particular life force energy. And it's pretty serious, actually, when you look at the potential of that. So,
yeah, it is.
I always encourage people to get as many organic seeds as possible, and even this whole business of banning of herbs is just such a witch hunt. That I would call a witch hunt, because it's still messing with the feminine principle of nature to tell people what herbs they can grow and what herbs they can have. And I remember walking, and just not even 6 months ago, being in Ireland, and I went into a health food store. I forgot. I just wanted some simple herb, and the girl said, "Well, we can't sell that anymore. This isn't available anymore. That's not available anymore." And it was just ridiculous.
Yeah. And I'm doing my own landscaping now. We just bought a house last summer. And this spring will be the first spring in the house, obviously. And it's an old house, so it had old landscaping, and most of which was overgrown and neglected for a decade or more. And so I have to rip it out and then plant what I can where I can. And it's like, okay, we're going to plant a lot of herbs and stuff that are useful and good. And I have a thing with plants to begin with. So, I have an excellent portion of shade versus sun, and it's going to give me an opportunity to play with my plants, ground myself with nature.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Which That's I fantastic. Think is a good connection for me.
Yeah, very. Have you heard of a woman named Penny Kelly?
Penny Kelly? No, I don't believe so.
Penny Kelly, it's the most fascinating woman. She wrote a book years ago on the elves. Here was this really grounded, practical person who bought land in Michigan, I believe, huge acreage, had some vineyards on it and everything. And I forgot what I think she was an engineer. She was a research engineer. And walking her property, and all of a sudden these little voices started to talk to her. Okay. So her whole book is about the elves on her property. But I bring it up only because they started telling her how to landscape her land and how to get, triple yield out of her vineyards. And, I thought, I'm only in the beginning of the book, and I've heard about things like this happen, especially with Paralandra, for example. But I'm thinking, why aren't we all in connection with that aspect of life? Because, certainly, they seem to be masters in terms of gardening and land and where everything should flow and everything else. So it just made me think of that when you were talking about your place.
It's funny you bring up the little people. I used to live in Arizona. For most of my life I lived there, and we were camping on the Mogollon Rim, which is a huge cliff that runs kind of diagonal across to Arizona. And we were in, it's ponderosa pines mostly. We would frequently camp under this one particularly large old gamble oak. And at night, after the sun went down, we had a little fire and everything, the little people would dance in the trees, and I would tell my kids stories about them. And years later, my daughter went back to that same place to camp, and that particular oak was dying. And she was just heartbroken, because for her it was like a whole lot more than just one old tree was dying.
Right.
You know, and I found that kind of amazing, that something from when she was, you know, a kid should affect her still as an adult.
Right. That's right.
So, yeah.
Well, even so, you know, my granddaughter and I always talk about the fairy kingdom, but, you know, we do it in a playful way. I mean, I totally believe in them and spend a lot of time in Ireland, which, of course, they're obvious beings over there that nobody really questions. But, you know, even reading a little bit of this woman's book, I thought, I am not in a relationship with these beings like she is, and I would really like to be. Because, you know, in terms of what we know as humans, and we're just not connected in the same way, I just think they're just full of information, you know?
Uh-huh. So. Well, it makes you think about the world in a slightly different way, you might say.
Right.
So, yeah, the stories are good for reconnecting ourselves to an older time period, maybe, to the past.
To the past. But it's a past, too, that's still very much alive.
Right.
And that's actually one of the, when I got into grid work, well, that actually came through some gray whales appearing to me in a vision, but I was walking through this forest preserve area in Chicago, because in Chicago, you know, there's not a lot of natural forest, but they have these little areas set aside, you know, that are called forest preserves. I was walking through this park/forest preserve area and with a friend, and we came upon this area that was just dead. I mean, you know how you see that sometimes if you're driving along the highway, you'll go past forest and there'll be areas that seem to be dead, and then you drive along and next thing you know everything's alive again. So we see this dead area, so my friend decides to walk through it, and then he goes, you better not walk through there because there's some negative energies in there. So I said, oh, okay. So I walked through it anyway because I had to check it out for myself. And I'm like, oh, yeah, you're right. I definitely feel that. And I'm walking out of the circle, and next thing you know, I hear these voices from underneath the ground saying, please come back. Please come back and help us. And next thing you know, just like automatically, I start walking in this counterclockwise spiral all the way through this dead area, and I must have done it for a couple hours. And when I left, they asked me if I'd build that counterclockwise spiral in stones. And I thought, oh, my God, that'll take me another 2 hours. But my friend and I did it. We made this big, huge spiral all over this area. And I don't even know what made me start doing it. I just started doing it. Well, we go back a week later, and the whole thing was like a foot-high grass through the whole thing.
Uh-huh.
That started me understanding that counterclockwise energy brings magnetic energy up from the earth and energizes the soil. But I was reacting from some old knowledge that I must have had, like you mentioned, ancient times ago. And, you know, since then I've been asked by those kingdoms to do all sorts of things. But I just find it interesting, you know, that's still so much alive, and, you know, we treat it like it's just stories and old myths, but, you know, they're still very much alive.
There's a whole lot more to it. Well, folks, it is time for us to take a break. So while we're waiting for your computer, don't go anywhere, and we'll be back in just a few minutes. Hey, hi there. Got your attention? I'm Gia Scott, and I was curious what you were doing from 7 to 9 p.m. Central Time on Tuesdays. See, I host this really interesting little radio program that airs live then, and we bring in all sorts of guests. Authors, experiencers, and everything in between. It's paranormal and guaranteed to make you go, My guest list is always up at www.giascott.com, and do tune in to the Dawn of Shades from 7 to 9 p.m. on Tuesdays.
Breaking news. Strange black pyramid UFO ships over every major city on the Earth. People are exhilarated and scared. Reptilian strange creatures are beaming down. My God! My God! They're beaming me up with them. Don't put that probe there. Don't put that probe there. Don't put a... Listen to the Church of Mabus radio show at 11 p.m. Eastern, Saturday nights with host Jeffrey Pritchett, bringing you The High Strange. Visit www.churchofmabusradio.com. That's www.churchofmabusradio.com.
Hey, it's Giorgio, the alien guy from the History Channel's Ancient Aliens. Join me, Ghostland Observatory, and so much more at the Sugar Mill for Cosmic Fest on Friday, December 21st to help prevent the end of the world. For tickets, visit CosmicFestNOLA.com.
Tune in to the Mind Cemetery with your hosts, Chip and Nicole, every Monday night at 9 p.m. Eastern.
Exclusively on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network. We delve into UFOs, abductions, ghosts, aliens, conspiracies, and cryptozoology.
And how could you ever forget about those creepy topics you won't hear on your local news?
This is where I would insert my obligatory skeptical statement. The Mind Cemetery, where the paranoia about the paranormal comes to rest.
Follow us on Twitter and subscribe to us on Facebook. Also, check us out on our website, mindcemetery.com, for show updates and the critically acclaimed Mind Cemetery blog.
It's not critically acclaimed, but you should check it out anyway, terry.com.
Hi, I'm Stephanie Benetti, and along with Joe Montaldo, we co-host a new show called News on the Flip Side. You can catch us every Saturday night, 8 p.m. Central, where we will be discussing current events and topics going on in the world today. We have opinions on everything. There's no topic that we won't discuss, and we'll go places that other shows wouldn't dare. False history gets made all day, every day. The truth of the new is never on the news. But you can catch it here, News on the Flip Side, only on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network.
Hi, everybody. This is Erica Getch. I hope to see you on Friday at 8 p.m. Pacific on the Galactic Connection, keeping you connected 1 hour at a time. For more information, please visit thegalacticconnection.com.
To UFO Undercover, Wednesdays at 8 p.m. Eastern, with your host, Joe Montaldo, right here on the Paranormal Radio Network.
Welcome back to the Dawn of Shades. I'm your host, Gia Scott, and tonight we are talking with Angel Rose O'Grady. Don't forget, send in your questions to my email, giascott@exogenynetwork.com. And before we get started again, Angel, would you let everyone know where they can find your website?
Okay, I will. Thank you. All right, they can get me at angelrose.com. That's the website, AINGELROSE.com, angelrose.com. And if they need to email me, they can email me at angelrose@angelrose.com. And if they're interested in the book, A Time of Change, they can find it, if they're in this country, at atimeofchange.info. And it's also on Amazon, and it's in all the electronic formats.
Well, I've recently become a fan of electronic formats. I have a number of books. I have Kindle on my PC. I haven't gone ahead and bought a Kindle yet, but I probably will at some point in the future. I find that it's an easy way to have a lot of books without taking up a lot of bookshelf space.
Well, I think they say it's 80% of the book sales now. our electronic format, which is pretty amazing.
Well, but when I consider the number of books that I have to move, anytime I move, I'm like, you know, the e-format is really pretty good.
It
weighs a lot less.
Yeah, and it costs a lot less, too.
Yeah, it costs a lot less, and, you know, in general, you know, sort of ecologically sound. No, I do have some books that, because sometimes I'll admit, I just want a book I can lay down on the table and leaf through. But, you know, most things, I prefer to read through electronic format. It's much easier to highlight them. I can remove the highlight later. I can add notes. I can do all sorts of things.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I do like that.
Yeah. A lot, obviously, a lot of people do because it's gaining popularity, that's for sure. Although I do still like my written, I like my paper. I'm like, you know, a bit like you. I can only look at the computer for just so long, or a computer-type device, and then I've had it. So I just think I'm very sensitive to whatever kind of light they're using on it. Even when I write my book, I do it all on the computer, but probably 2 hours a day is my max. That's it.
I can remember in the old days of computers, back when it was monochrome monitors, and I literally had the equivalent of sunburned eyes.
Mm-hmm.
And I had to get glasses with UV protection in them because I worked with computers at least 8 hours a day. I had to be able to go home and not feel like I had been through, I don't know, sort of sandblasting. My eyes felt terrible. And, you know, for several years, that's the only reason I wore glasses at all. I mean, now I wear glasses again. That's, you know, age catching up with me. But at that time, that's what I wore them for, was the UV protection. I find screens now are much easier with aging eyes. It also allows me to cheat sometimes and make the fonts bigger.
Yeah.
So I have been known to do that on many occasions. You know, I know some people that are also sight impaired, and, you know, they're not totally blind, but reading normal print is difficult for them. And if anybody who's ever looked for large print format books, they're often abridged. They're often expensive, and they're not available for all books. So for them, you know, there again, the e-book format is sort of a godsend because
it's
format.
True.
I do adjust the brightness on my screen. I'll admit that. It makes my other half kind of crazy when I have it turned down low because there's days when I'm sort of light sensitive.
Yeah.
And so I do turn the screen down dimmer than usual.
Have you noticed, speaking of sensitivity to things, you know, have you noticed with the changing times that we're in and the shift in all of the grids and the increase in sunspots and earthquakes, do you wake up some days being super hypersensitive? Because I certainly do.
Well, I probably do, and I blame it on other things, because like most people who are getting older, my body is sort of rebelling, I guess, at times. In addition, all those things that we did to ourselves when we were younger and our doctors told us, oh, you're healing fine, they were lying. It's going into remission. When you hit that magical 5-0 number, they're going to come calling again and say, hey, howdy, I'm here, remember me? Yeah.
Yeah,
so there are days when, you know, I'm probably very sensitive to things. There's days when I'm really not very sociable. I always figured that, you know, sort of fall back on my mother's lesson of, if you can't say something nice, don't say anything nice at all. If I can't be nice to people, don't talk to people at all.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
So when I'm not having a good day, I tend to be extremely reclusive. I would say there's times what I'm blaming it on, you know, could probably vary. I don't know if it's changes in me, changes in the world, changes in the electromagnetic field that, you know, makes up me and the world I live in. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have noticed really interesting, you know, phenomena like before December 21st, for example. And I think it started when my husband and I were driving from North Carolina down to San Diego. We actually left at the end of October, so we took our time. I think we got here like November 6th or something. But the closer we got to California, we started feeling this depression. And neither one of us really get depressed. And we're like, what is this depressed energy that we're feeling? And, you know, it kept increasing and increasing. And then it went into these phases of dread. You know, like we were like, oh, my God, this, if you had to describe it, it was like this huge sadness and huge anxiety. And then at a bookstore here, I did a group Akash session. And the people who came, you know, one of their questions was, you know, what's going on? What's this sadness that we're all feeling and this anxiety? And I thought, wow, you know, other people are feeling this too. And we just watched it. We were just waking up with it, thinking, what's going on? And then all of a sudden, getting close to the 21st, it just lifted. It just was gone. And the opposite took its place. It actually felt like suddenly we'd all been blessed by this incredible, wonderful, sacred energy. And so we've been just kind of been watching that from day to day. It certainly feels that that has shifted, that there is some sort of beneficial energy. And I actually did go in and ask Source about it, and I did see huge blessings being shed, you know, from the center of the universe down through all of creation, really, not really just Earth. But so, you know, I always tell people that this is really an incredible time to be putting forth any sort of healing intention, because the energies are real supportive now since we've turned a corner. And, you know, and I'm somebody who doesn't necessarily think that it happens like that, you know, that one day it's one thing and the next day it's shifted. But this was obvious. This was very surprisingly obvious. So that's why I asked the question.
Well, you know, I guess thinking back about it, I did know that a number of people were feeling very tense, very anxious, depressed, you know, probably from about October up until the December 21st thing.
Yeah.
And I kind of blamed it on, it's like this group consciousness. We had, you know, all these people who were so sure that on December 21st there was going to be some huge, major disaster. And then nothing happened. Well, even for the people that didn't really believe that anything terrible was going to happen on December 21st, there was this level of anxiety because they're dealing with people that did believe that something terrible was going to happen that day.
Right.
And so there was this, you know, underlying anxiety, and then when the date finally arrived, it's like, okay, arrived December 21st. Now we can start building again.
Exactly. Exactly. You know? And I know, too, I did go in and ask Source about what was all the sorrow about. And, you know, what I was actually shown was that the light has been increasing on the planet. And it was, Source was saying, as the light increases, it kind of squeezes out, you know, anything unlike itself. And so, you know, I saw a lot of our unhealed grief. We all seem to have buried a whole bunch of issues, you know, that we all do when we have to cope with life every day. But it seemed like it was all coming out into the environment, and that was part of what was happening. So I thought, yeah, we're all feeling each other's unhealed stuff. But it did seem to clear or shift. And, of course, some people blame it on those the shootings in Connecticut. They were saying that maybe we were all feeling that coming. But I thought, you know, there's so many tragedies that go on every single day of our lives, entries that are equally as devastating, and we all don't feel that way, you know? We don't pick
right
up on them like that. So I didn't really buy that one, you know? It didn't really feel right to me that was the case. But anyway, certainly feels that we have turned a corner. But like you, what I've noticed also about myself is that I have days where I'm just really tired, and I since the 21st, and I just need to hibernate and rest, and that's something new for me. So, but I'm just going with it, you know, whatever it is, so.
Yeah, I kind of, you know, I guess my Christmas gift was catching cold or flu or whatever little virus I've been nursing, and that's forced me to sort of slow down. Sometimes I chomp at the bit because, you know, this is interfering with things I wanted to and needed to do.
Right.
But maybe sometimes we have to be forced to, you know, take stop, rest a little bit, recharge.
Yeah, I think so. Mm-hmm. I think so, too. And like I told you, I spent most of the day just hanging out in my bed.
So. Yeah,
you know, I had readings, and I just did them from my bed. So.
Yeah, you know, it just comes a point where you're like, okay, I'm physically tired, I don't feel well, I've got to rest, and to do anything else but that would really be counterproductive.
Right, that's right. Mm-hmm. Yep, and I'm also like you, if I know that I'm not in a good mood when I get up, I avoid interaction socially as much as I can. So.
Yeah, I have to admit, there's days when my husband deserves a Purple Heart.
I know. I understand that one, too.
Yeah. And then I do something nice to kind of try and show my appreciation, you know, something special for him or whatever.
I know. Okay, cool.
Yeah, well, you know, that's sort of the thing is that, you know, the people that we care about the most, you know, usually is our partner, and they're the ones that are stuck with us even when we're having a bad day. Of course, it's
right.
The vice versa is true. We're stuck with them when they have a bad day, too. But, yeah, you know, there's days when, yeah, I've told people often, he deserves a Purple Heart.
Yeah.
Brave man.
Yeah. I know, I have a really well-tempered husband myself. He's just a peach. And I, you know, I'll go back and I'll apologize, and he'll say, it's all right, Angel Rose, I know you're just having another moment.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking I wouldn't be nearly as tolerant of him if he was doing that. So,
yeah, anyway. I'm one of these people that, you know, I have lots of small explosions. You know, I'm easily frustrated, but I explode in these little ones. And, you know, 5 minutes from now, I'll have forgotten about it. I'm over it. You know, I've learned, let it off all that steam in these little pops, and, you know, it's not a big deal. But if you let it build up and build up, then there's an explosion, it can be a big deal.
Right.
So, yeah, I tend to, you know, vent frequently in small amounts, and the world is good. Yeah.
Yes.
And he has all his limbs.
Well, I do think, you know, even though we sound like we're talking about, you know, casual discussion, I think the truth of it is that we all need to be able to just be okay with how we are and how we're changing and, you know, the things that go on day to day rather than, you know, I know so many people that, you know, they have to be on their spiritual path, and if they're not on their spiritual path and they're not doing the absolute best, then they get all concerned about if they're going to ascend or not. And, you know, I just think, geez, the whole process is just to be human and not to censor yourself, you know?
So. Well, I guess I kind of regard it's like walking a path. A turtle can go down the same path as an antelope, and it might take them longer to get there. But the turtle takes it one small step at a time.
Right.
The antelope may leap 10 or 20 feet at a time and then have to stop and eat for an hour or two or whatever. You know, you still get there. Does it really matter if you do it with a lot of flash and dash or with that little unnoticeable snail-like pace?
Right.
So, yeah, I figure I'll get there, and it's not going anywhere, so I'll get there.
Mm-hmm.
And rather than wasting my energy worrying about whether or not I'm going fast enough, I'll just worry about putting one foot in front of the other.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's very good advice. Very practical advice. All right.
Yeah, well, it sort of comes along. If anyone has ever met with a physical endurance experience of having to make a journey physically that is a little bit beyond their true abilities, you do get to that point where it is literally one foot in front of the other. Don't think about it. Don't think about how bad you hurt or how far down it is beside you or up it is still. Just put one foot in front of the other, and eventually you're going to get there.
Yeah.
You know, and it is. It's a very similar experience. There's times when I think about, you know, we were talking earlier about rituals. Once upon a time, a common ritual for coming of age or, you know, other significant milestones in one's life was a ritual involving physical endurance.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And that's because it does have the lessons to teach you.
Mm-hmm.
It isn't really about being fast or being able to run a long ways. It's about just getting there.
Mm-hmm. Right. And I don't think we have too many rituals like that anymore.
No, today it seems to be things like graduating from high school, graduating from college,
right.
Your first home purchase, your first car purchase. You know, it seems to be centered on physical things.
Right. Well, I know in Ireland, my husband's children are in the what we call our Boy Scouts. I guess they call it their Boy and Girl Scouts too, but you know, they're in their 20s, and you know, in Ireland, the Boy Scouts, you get to a certain level, and then what they do is they take a group of scouts to a foreign country, and they drop them off in pairs of twos. So it would be like yourself and another person would be your partner. And they have to walk 250 miles to a particular destination. And they be allowed to use public transportation. I forgot, it's very, very small in comparison to the walking, but the whole point is that all they have is a map. They don't really, they have to totally rely on the people in the area. And even if that's, like, I think his son was dropped off in Serbia, for example. And they had to learn to communicate with the Serbian people. They had to be asked to be taken into their homes so that they'd have places to sleep. They had to learn how to cook some of their food, and this all had to be logged. And then they had to get to the destination, you know, within, like, 4 or 5 days.
Uh-huh.
And I find that I think that's a pretty good rite of passage to be able to do something like that. And then his daughter just did it too. They dropped her off somewhere in Greece, and she had to do the same thing. But there obviously were a lot of them that didn't really make it the whole way, you know?
Yeah.
But I think that was such a valuable experience, and part of their motive was not only for self-efficiency, but also if you want to learn about another country, the best way to do it is be among the people. And,
right.
And I thought that was fantastic, actually. And I think everybody should go through something like that in their lives. You know,
When I was a teenager, we moved from Iowa to Arizona. And I had cousins in Arizona and New Mexico. When I first arrived there, I couldn't even understand what they were saying. They were speaking English. I couldn't understand them.
Mm-hmm.
I can't even imagine what it'd be like to try to deal with a foreign language.
Right. Yeah, especially Serbian. I mean, what is that, Croatian? I wonder if that's the language. But, me neither, because I just remember when I was in school, of course, they taught you French. You could pick a subject, remember, Spanish or French. And I just didn't, you know, I don't know where the heck I was anyway when I was in school. I think I was out in the ozone even at that age. But I couldn't sit still in my chair. I'd probably be your typical ADD child today, but, you know, both things never came easy for me. And, you know, here's my husband's son. You know, he had to do a year of college in France as well, and you know, as soon as he got there, he picked up his phone, and it was bonjour, and it was this, and all the teachers taught them in French.
So
it's kind of like you had to buck up or fail, one or the other. You had to learn it or fail, so...
Yeah, I remember back to, you know, my days of, in my case, it was Spanish and German. And, you know, one grandfather spoke German and was his first language, even though he'd been born in the United States. But he had died by the time I was a teenager. And my other grandfather did speak Spanish. But the way he put it, if I'd been born in Mexico, I'd have had a severe speech impediment. I couldn't make a lot of the sounds in Spanish. I learned to understand it fairly well, but I never did learn to speak it with a hoot.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it was very difficult for me. The German was actually much easier. At least I could make the sounds.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's the way it is with Irish for me. I mean, when I hear Irish people speak, you know, they speak Irish. My husband can speak Irish. That they have a certain way of pronouncing words that my tongue just does not do. And... you know, I think, God, how wonderful to be able to be brought up in that and be able to do that with your mouth. I mean, you're right. It is the way that sounds are said and the way they're pronounced. And, you know, I listen to him and I like, there's just no way I could get those inflections in there. But
it's like, I cannot roll an R. I don't care what you do. I cannot roll an R. I have no idea how to make those sounds. And I can remember my daughter, just a few months old, she would lay and just roll an R continuously for, you know, 5 minutes at a time. She thought it was right. The most amusing thing she could do. And I was like, how does she make that sound? You know, because I had never been able to make it. And, you know, my granddaughter does the same thing now, and it's like, I still cannot figure out how do they make that sound. In the Navajo language, there are certain sounds that I understand physically how they're made. Can I repeat them? No. Because it's a strange glottal stop. But it's almost like a clicking sound to me. And could I repeat it? No. I never learned to speak Navajo at all. I wouldn't even say I have a very good understanding of it, because it is a real complex language, to me anyhow. So, you know, these languages, and in addition to the difference in sounds, I hear the world in terms of patterns. Everybody's speech has a pattern to me. And various dialects and languages have their own, you know, overall pattern, too. Somebody from Ireland or Scotland or the UK or Australia or New Zealand, Canada, or various parts of the United States, they all have a different pattern to their basic language. And some of them I just can't duplicate.
Right. Right. Well, I hear you on that one. So,
yeah, people are gifted at being able to mimic anything they hear. You know, I envy them in a way.
Right. Yeah, that wouldn't be me.
No, that's definitely not me. Although everybody tells me there's very little left of the, you know, traditional Iowa accent in my speech anymore. But it took years, because for a number of years I wouldn't even say the word Iowa if I could possibly avoid it, because it was the one place that Midwestern nasal twang came out so loud it would just make me cringe, because nobody else had it.
Right.
So, you know, it did sound strange to me after being away for a number of years. And I listen to people even now, and it still doesn't come back. I cannot repeat it.
Right.
I work so hard to get rid of it.
I think it's interesting, too, how other people, you know, themselves, you know, like when I met my husband and he had that wonderful Irish accent. And yet, to him, I had an accent, and to me, I don't have an accent, you know?
Uh-huh.
But how you sound to other people, you know, when you think that the way you talk is just the normal way to talk. And then you hear other people, and you go, wow, look at that accent. And they look at you and go, wow. I mean, he'd call me from Ireland, and his friends would be on the other end, and they'd just sit there, because they'd love to listen to my accent. And I'd say, but the same thing happens here, especially with females. They love to hear my husband talk, you know?
Uh-huh.
And, you know, I just think the accents are really, really kind of strange in and of themselves. But my husband was one when he lived in Egypt for a time, and he said within a month he knew the language. And that's a hard language. And So he said he knew that he must have lived there in a prior life because it just came right back to him real easy. And I do think some people have that still within them, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Well, when I think about it, too, here in the United States, people have perceptions that they associate with certain language or certain accents. Now, to most people, I have an accent. But to someone from the South, they can tell I'm not from the South.
Right. Well, I don't think you sound like you're from the South.
I'd
say you would be more Midwestern or even upstate New York. That's what you sound like to me.
Yeah,
yeah. You know. Right.
So, you know, and I've never even been to New York. You know, and so I come from a sort of multicultural family, and I did move around a fair amount. But to me, when I hear my voice, I have a typical Arizona type of accent. Okay? And Arizona is mostly made up of people who came from someplace else.
Right.
You know, very few people were actually born in Arizona, it seems. But, you know, that is true, is that, you know, I did spend the majority of my life there, and that sort of finished off how I learned to speak was with that type of an accent. Now, to people that I would meet from the East Coast, often they would say, you know, think that I have this Southern drawl, and for some reason that Southern drawl is associated with being stupid or uneducated.
Well, or, you know, really conservative.
Yeah, that too.
Redneck. How about redneck? Does that fit?
Yeah, you know, really conservative, really uneducated, you know, pretty ignorant, in a lot of ways. And, yes, I can talk like if I so chose to, but coming from a family of school teachers, there's something in me that says, you know, you must enunciate your words properly. But, you know, it's strange how we do sort of overlay our expectations of someone by merely the sound of their voice.
Right, that's true. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know I had opinions about people from the South for many years, and, you know, then I was thrown down into the Asheville, Hendersonville, North Carolina area, and you know, boy, did I resist that for a good 2 or 3 years. You know, I kept complaining that it was such a slower pace of life, and I was stagnating. I'd go and have a friend who does, you know, snakes, soul journeys, and every time she'd do a journey, she'd say, "Oh yeah, you're still meant to be in North Carolina," and I'm like, "You got to be kidding me! What could possibly be the reason?" And, you know, it turns out that all of a sudden our soul family just popped up everywhere. And talk about the nicest, most loyal, heart-centered people as friends. And there is a whole spiritual community in Hendersonville and Nashville. And it's like every time you turned around, more and more people were moving there from all over the place. But I can never say enough about, you know, the friendliness of the people and helpful. You know, like we were moving, and next thing you know, I had all these people call me and say, "Okay, you know, we're arranging a moving party. We're coming over to help you pack." And it's like, really? You know, who does that?
Yeah, you know, like I think about it when we were house hunting and whatnot, we sort of... It was like the house found us eventually.
Right.
But until I finally looked at this particular house, nothing worked out. It was like I was destined to be in this house. We actually put the offer in on this house probably within 10 minutes of looking at it, and it was a done deal before we got 30 miles away.
Oh, my gosh.
I mean, that's how quickly, you know, it was a done deal. We didn't close for a couple weeks because it takes a while for lawyers to do their thing, but it was a done deal. We were committed to it. We had, you know, signed the contract and whatnot. The offers had all come, you know, together, and we had the house. Did I ever think that I was going to move to a small town near Hattiesburg, Mississippi? If anybody had told me this even 10 years ago, I'd have fell out of my chair laughing. If they told me this 15 years ago, I probably would have, you know, had a seizure laughing so hard. You know, I had no intentions of ever moving anywhere east of the Mississippi. I mean, really. I've concluded there's a reason why I'm here, okay? Even if I don't know what it is yet. I mean, because it's like this house, we were just supposed to have this house.
Right.
Was it the way I want it? No.
That's the way I eventually got to feel about the Carolinas. I kind of surrendered and said, all right, you know, I don't quite know what I'm doing here. But what I was noticing was that a lot of healing occurred for me there, you know? And it really made me see the parts of me that really did need healing. And for some reason, because it was functioning at a bit of a slower pace, and I had downtime, and it was actually where I wrote my book. You know, I had a friend who just had an empty house, and she said, I need a house sitter, go stay at my house. Didn't charge me anything to live there, and said, you know, beautiful land, the land was full of elementals, and said, you know, you just sit there and write. And so that's actually where I got the book finished. So when we came here to San Diego, we were kind of a little shell-shocked because I've never really been a wealthy person either, and of course the prices here are crazy, and we started looking around, and it was no, 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 and it was just nuts. So I finally just said to my husband, I'm not looking anymore. You know, this is struggle, and I'm not doing struggle anymore, so I'm not looking for any place, and Source will just have to bring it to us. And literally 2 days later, the woman that we're staying with now called a friend of hers who was the friend we were staying with temporarily. And all of a sudden she just says, yeah, I'm thinking of renting a room out of my home. And next thing you know, we meet her, and it was as soon as she opened the door, she just grabbed my hands, and it was like this instant soul recognition. And she needed help too. She was in a bit of a depression for some things that were going on in her life. And as it turned out, she provided this wonderful space for us, which really we have the whole house, and 15 minutes from my granddaughter, and we've helped her just by being here. You know, she's kind of come back online with her spirituality. So, I mean, I couldn't have picked that myself, and this isn't where we're meant to stay for a long time, I know that. But just to how, you know, as soon as I just turned it over and said, whatever, I'm not doing this myself. Just whatever's the right place, let it come to us. And literally 2 days later, we moved in. So I love it when those kinds of things happen, those synchronicities or those things. But you're lucky. I've never owned a home my whole entire life. And I would love to know what that is like. So hasn't happened yet, though.
You know, this is going to be an interesting experience, I'm sure. We bought an old house, which, of course, for anybody who's ever done so, that means renovations.
Yes, it does. Yeah.
You know, lots of renovations have to be done over the next year or two. And we actually, it was a strange purchase. This house had been owned by the same people from the time it was built until they died. And we bought it from the estate. We're only the second owners, despite the fact this is a very old house.
Wow.
So, it's kind of one of those very rare things that you see. However, it did come with some extras, you might say. It came with all the junk.
Oh, my God.
60-plus years of junk.
Oh, my God. Yes, okay.
And
that one.
And these people hoarded everything. If anybody is in any need of TV trays, remember TV dinners from the 60s and 70s?
I do.
There's a box of them in the garage.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, so, you know, we've seen a window into the past, in a way, reminders of things that I had long since forgot about. I'd forgotten about those little foil trays with the little dividers and... Yeah, you put them in the oven, and the potatoes would get all crunchy and around the edges, and so forth and so on. all those things I'd forgot about, you know, came back as we were cleaning out, emptying out, and so forth and so on. Yeah. So it did. It come with all the junk.
Curiosity. I do remember those were fun, those little TV dinners. Such a special treat.
Yes, it was. It was a special treat, you know, and I think about it after the microwave and those little entrees. Those no longer were a treat. That was something I typically would, you know, grab out of the freezer and throw in a bag and take with me to work, you know, because I could nuke it at work and it wasn't going to spoil before lunchtime and, you know, it was easy. There was no treat involved in it. No sitting in front of the TV with a TV tray and so forth and so on. And it was a special treat. You know, usually I only ate them when I was at my grandmother's house and we would watch something like Ma and Pa Kettle.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, late night TV, all these things that you didn't normally do except at home.
Right, and look at the kids today. I mean, they couldn't even relate. And I look at my six-year-old, he has her own iPad, you know.
Uh-huh.
And the stuff that they're exposed to, I can only imagine when they're adults what it's going to be like when they look back. Because probably what they're doing now is going to be primitive.
Probably. Yeah. I mean, you know, now we can access the internet from literally anywhere. Just about. I mean, with an air card or satellite internet, you can get it just about anywhere. Varying degrees of success. But even computers. I mean, I can remember when there were these huge clunky things that crashed and would lose everything.
Right.
And you'd have to start all over entering data again.
I know.
You know, when you know, various government agencies and companies were first computerizing, it was a long, arduous process. And I don't know how many times I entered the same data I'd entered last month and the month before because the system had crashed again.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, it's come a long ways,
mm-hmm.
especially in terms of reliability. You know, when we're talking about the Akashic Records, though, because we're getting down to the last few minutes of the program, you know, how does all this information access that we have today, how does it compare, or what are the Akashic Records, how do they refer to it back and forth?
Like, what do you mean? How does...
Well, you know, when you talk about Source, you know, talking about things going on in our life, how does that regard the information access that we have dependent on?
Yeah, well, Source does address technology. And it does warn us a bit about our dependency upon it, because for this reason, because it says that we actually do have a whole communication system that is organic inside of our own biology, and it would prefer that we learn to use that more in terms of telepathy with one another, in terms of communication on levels that actually come from our own network, how we're made up internally. So there were exercises in the book to practice with others, to share, you know, telepathy with one another or with family members who lived across the globe, for example. And it was doing it for a couple of reasons. It was basically saying that, number one, it's a communication network that you have with all life everywhere that really was in danger of losing its organic crystalline structure because of all the technology and because of the foods and all sorts of things that were changing, you know, the composition of the crystal network inside us. So it was concerned about, it kept using the word organic, talking about our organic structure. And it viewed technology as taking us away from that, you know, becoming too dependent on outside things for communication purposes. So that was its main advice. Plus, it did go into some of the negative agendas, usage of technology and usage of, you know, nerve networks in our biology to spread fear. So there's a big chapter in there about how they do that and interfere with our own energy systems because they know more about them than we do. So there was a lot of stuff in there. And, you know, on the one hand, technology is fantastic for so many things. But I just think along with that, you know, Source was saying, don't forget what you're made of. You know, don't forget what you've got inside your own systems. So that was the advice. It was looking at frequencies, you know, low-grade frequencies that get pulsed from devices and things as damaging to our immune system and things like that. So, you know, it wanted us to be aware of a lot of things about technology that weren't necessarily in our best interest, while still saying, yeah, you know, of course you need a computer to do your business and this and that these days. So I thought it was pretty, that particular evening was pretty mind-blowing in some of the things that it told us. But it, you know, all of that is explained in a lot of detail. Might take longer than what we have here now, but it was specifically talking about the nerve network in our solar plexus, that we have a huge nerve network there that connects us to all life everywhere, you know, into this web, right? Connects us to other people at that level of the solar plexus, connects us to the energetic web around the earth. But it's also the place where many of us feel emotions will be in our gut. So it was suggesting that some of the not-so-nice agendas out there will pulse really low-frequency energies into the atmosphere how we react to that is we start to have negative emotions or fearful emotions, and those get sent through our solar plexus, and that goes out into the web. So it keeps human beings at a fear level that really wouldn't be there if they weren't messing with us. And that's indicative of a lot of the suicides that we've seen occur over the past few years, where, you know, the rates of them are just phenomenal in terms of how many people are taking themselves out, all ages, and for some no apparent reasons. I mean, you'll hear stories from the families that'll say, you know, this person was fine, and all of a sudden, you know, they've committed suicide, and with no explanation, no clue, no nothing. Okay? And so, you know, it really talked to us a lot about that, you know, our biologies and how they get used and how we create these fear states, you know, and they get orchestrated sometimes by not-so-nice agendas. So.
Yeah. Now, is this first book that you've written, isn't that one of a series that's in the works?
It is. The second one is called The Nature of Reality, and it will be transcripts of questions and answers that people have asked all about reality and other dimensions and time and miracles and wisdom of the body and all sorts of things that relate to various aspects of realities, really, different realities. So it'll cover a lot of interesting things. It was originally supposed to come out in April, but due to some unforeseen circumstances, it's going to come out in the fall of this year instead. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. All righty. Well, that's just
on and on. Yeah.
People for something to look forward to. Now, we are winding down to the last few minutes. You want to tell everybody about your website and the name of your book again?
Okay. All right. The first book is called The Time of Change, and it can be found on Amazon.com, and it can be found in all the electronic formats, or it can be ordered directly from myself by going to timeofchange.info. That's all one word, timeofchange.info. My website is www.angaelrose.com. That's AINGEALROSE.com. And I can be emailed at angaelrose@angaelrose.com.
That's pretty simple. As long as people remember that Engel is not spelled in the usual manner. So, yeah, everybody don't forget. Pay attention to how Engel spelled it. It's sort of, becomes second nature, I guess, after you get used to looking at it. But it is slightly different spelling than what we're accustomed to. So, yeah, remember that, everyone. Engel, I've had an absolute ball with you on the program tonight, and I want to thank you very much for coming on with us.
Well, thank you, too, for having me and to all your listeners who are listening. Thank you.
Yeah, well, folks, we're running out of time here. I want to thank everyone for listening, and I hope that tonight's program has given everyone plenty of food for thought, as well as more illumination for your personal journey towards truth. Tune in again next time as we bring another guest, another topic, and a whole new idea for your consideration. You've been listening to The Dawn of Shades, and I'm your host, Gia Scott, and good night.
I'd say things over.
This is the Kevin Smith Show.
Comments and views expressed on The Kevin Smith Show are those of the people that make them and do not necessarily reflect the views of Kevin Smith, The Kevin Smith Show, or its affiliates or sponsors.
Welcome to the Kevin Smith Show, ladies and gentlemen, whoever you are, wherever you are, all around this beautiful place we call Earth, thank you for being here at the Kevin Smith Show. Talk radio like nowhere else on this planet. It's the show where you matter, and I'm delighted you're here. I want to thank all of you who tuned in on Saturday. You tuned in to Dave Corso's new radio show. I want to thank you for that. It was, I was the guest, and you know, it's a little bit different being on the other side of the mic, and you never really know, you know, what's this host going to ask, and so I appreciate your support. Thank you for being there. I also want to thank all of you who joined me in the chat room on Saturday night. We had a good time, and I appreciate you being there. You know, we have a lot of calls to this show and emails that express a great interest in the future. More specifically, a lot of people are very, very concerned about the future and in some cases very frightened about the future. And they're looking for any little tidbit of information that will either help to reassure them about the future or help them to feel that they are better prepared for what they think is coming. So in looking for those little tidbits of information. People look at a lot of different sources. Some people look to psychics and mediums. Some to prophets like Nostradamus and Edgar Casey. Some turn to religion and look at the prophecies in their holy books. And some people turn to the Webbot. You know about the Webbot project? Well, tonight we're going to be talking with Cliff High, who is half of the Webbot team, and he's going to join us on the other side of our first break. We're going to be talking about the Webbot project. Some people think it's very, very accurate, and they have a lot of confidence in it. Some people feel like the Webbot is just sort of a random hit and miss game. Well, we'll talk with Cliff High about that tonight. Let me remind you that we have a free weekly newsletter called the K-Files. Now, the K-Files, when we say it's free, it really is free. No politician doublespeak here. It's just free. And it's a good publication, and I encourage you to get it. All you have to do is just sign up for it, subscribe to it. And you do that at my website, kevinsmithshow.com. And you just click that link that says K-Files and subscribe. And then you're going to get a confirmation email with a link in it that you have to click in order to activate your subscription. All right? So you do that and start getting the K-Files. Then you'll no longer be in the dark. You don't have to be in the dark. And you got to ask yourself, where is the genius in being in the dark when you don't have to? We'll be back right after this. It is my pleasure to welcome Cliff High, half of the WebBot team, to the Kevin Smith Show. Cliff, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Cliff, I know that most of my audience is very well aware of the WebBot project, but the fact is we're in over 140 countries, and that means we have new listeners each and every night. Some of them may not know anything about the WebBot project, so let's start off with just a little thumbnail description of what is it.
Sure. It's a method of doing forecasts of a future kind of event that occurs as a result of sort of psychic leaking out into everybody's conversations on the Internet.
Okay. So if you harvest a massive amount of information off of the Internet and you analyze it, somehow that shows you a trend? I'm sorry?
Right. You boil it down to a thick, syrupy mass and that sort of thing.
Uh-huh. Okay. Now, this gives you then, I guess we can call them some predictive statements or predictions.
Basically, what we end up with is a collection of words that are clustered under set theory into various archetype groups. These archetype groups are then you drill down to detail layers, and it provides us, if you will, manifestations that might show up in the archetypes. We work under the assumption that everybody is psychic. Most people don't know they're psychic, and even if they do know they're psychic, they're probably not aware of when they're being psychic, and some of this stuff leaks out.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so it's sort of just unconscious communications, unconscious things that we're putting in our communications that give you indicators.
Right, and the theory is somewhat complex. I mean, it's more than just scrubbing the Internet for language, because it works on the idea that we have, as individual humans, a base lexicon in our native language of maybe 100,000 words. Let's take English as an example. So we internalize and we know about 100,000 English words, but we might in any given year only use, say, 25,000 of those words that we know. And within that year, most of that year, we're keeping our vocabulary down to about, say, 5,000 words or to 11,000, depending on the nature of the work we have to do. And so if you're in a highly technical profession, your vocabulary is obviously skewed that direction. However, the idea is that there are types of stress which indicate sort of a foreknowledge or psychic intuition, if you will. We have to express that as humans, and we're sort of like a nagging thought kind of a deal. And you express it by leaking out some of the psychic impression because of the way you change your normal vocabulary. So you might have a regular habit of going to the bakery forum and discussing all the cool things that you bake at home. And then you have a regular vocabulary you use there, and if you were to really look at it, you'd probably find that you rarely strayed out of a set of, say, 2,500 words in that specific forum. And yet sometimes you do stray out of those 2,500 words and even have to reach for particular kinds of words. We capture the difference there, the appearance of those outlier words, and we make our projections based on those. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. All right.
By the way.
I'm sorry?
I'm getting a bit of an echo.
Do you have a volume control on your phone?
No, it's
what's happening is your phone line is very strong, and you're getting some feedback off of it.
Yeah.
All right, now look, the U.S. government developed over the years a track record of being very, very nervous about anyone that can make accurate predictions about the future. And they have a tendency to sort of sick the FBI on such folks. They investigate them, put them under surveillance, generally make life unpleasant for them. Since the WebBot has a reputation of having accurately predicted several of the rather momentous world events within the past few years, have you experienced any of that type of surveillance and harassment?
Not to the point where anybody's come up in my face. We've had some issues where electronically we've been harassed. There's no question about that. And our site was taken down precipitously without notice. They abrogated the commercial contract we had with the ISP, and we've had some interference that way at an electronic level, but no one's ever come on up and said, don't do this anymore.
Well, the reason I asked is because there seems to be no photographs of you anywhere on the internet and no biographical information. Is that for your own personal security or just privacy?
No, I'm just very private. I'm a private guy. I just, you know, I'm really actually immaterial to the whole work, relatively.
Okay.
So, well, I wasn't trying to be hidden or anything. I'm just, like I say, a private guy. I usually just want to go out, you know, and sailing or mucking about locally. So I didn't want to make a big fuss about myself relative to the work. Now that it's worked out this way, this is good, though.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, in the grand scheme of things, universe was probably watching out for my saggy butt here. But it wasn't the design at the time, no.
Okay. Now, probably the WebBot prediction that most people would be most familiar with, and I'm speaking about around the world, would be the prediction of the events that we now call 9-1-1 or 9-11. The WebBot made that prediction. But the questions that I have about that are, how far in advance did it make that prediction? You know, how far in advance of the event? And then, to what degree of specificity did it make the prediction?
Taking the latter part first, the specificity relates to the amount of language that we have defined into archives, etc. I did not have at the time that 9/11 happened, I did not have the lexicon anywhere near as complete as it is now, and I was up into the M's, I believe, and so I didn't have the T, terrorism word, modeled, so we did not get that word. We did get attack on the money center of the planet. We got the combination of a military accident, as though the data was trying to slap us upside the head because we didn't have terrorism modeled. It came up with the closest two archetypes that we did have at the time. Now, as to how early it was done, we actually posted something on June 11th or 12th of that year, 80-plus days ahead of the event.